Hey marketers, if you want to get the latest news, trends, and insights in marketing, advertising, and tech, check out the Adweek Podcast Network. Learn from leading voices across media and marketing with original shows like Yeah, That's Probably an Ad, Marketing Vanguard, and Tech Magic with Kathy Hackle. Start listening now by searching Adweek wherever you listen to podcasts.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/generate to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/generate. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Hey there, are you ready to elevate your personal brand or company? Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for video content and audience building. Imagine growing your brand organically on social media without the hassle of editing videos for hours. With Viral Growth, it's a breeze. They handle the brainstorming, scripting, and editing while you simply just hit record. And don't worry about your niche. They cater to everyone, from business and marketing to health and wellness. Are you ready to make waves in the social media realm? Visit viralgrowth.io and use code ADWEEK, that's ADWEEK, all lowercase, and get 10% off your plan.
You're listening to Yeah, That's Probably an Ad. This is the Adweek podcast where we talk about marketing, media, technology, pop culture, because in the end, everything is an ad. I'm David Greiner. I'm the international editor with Adweek. Back with me, as always, is Shannon Miller, our creative and inclusion editor. Shannon, always great to have you back.
Thank you. It's been a while since we've recorded together, actually.
I know. I realized as I said that, I was like, have you back? I'm like, wait, we're co-hosts. But it has been a minute since we were both on the show together. So it's great to chat. And speaking of somewhat frequent guests, we've got Stephen Leptak, our Europe Bureau Chief. Stephen, I think folks, if you listened to last week's podcast, may have heard his conversation with Trevor Beatty about going into space. But now we've got a very different topic to talk about. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, you guys can get rid of me.
He's like a bad penny or whatever you call it in the UK. This week we're going to be talking about two unrelated but fascinating things. One is a lawsuit in the UK that has really sent a lot of, I know it's cliche to say sent shockwaves through the industry, but it has sparked a ton of conversations and outrage within the industry. This is the discrimination case filed against the former agency known as JWT, now part of Wunderman Thompson. That was accused of basically targeting straight white older men with layoffs or redundancy, as it's called in the UK. And then that case just went in some directions and has sparked some subsequent conversations that go in a lot of different places. We'll be talking about that and just kind of what we see as some of the bigger implications for the industry. And then we're going to talk about the Olympics and how it's going on in terms of streaming, viewership, ad sales, ratings. We're going to have our TV, Convergent TV editor, Jason Lynch, in to talk. It's always great. Jason is literally the smartest person I've ever met when it comes to TV stuff. So we'll be great to hear from him on that. But let's start with JWT. So, Stephen, I'm gonna give my Stephen's been covering this. Stephen broke this story. It was an Adweek exclusive, but has since been picked up around the world, especially in the UK, as we will talk about with mixed results on the quality of that coverage, but very proud of Adweek's coverage and how Stephen has framed the story from the beginning and the context he's provided. So, Stephen, if it's okay with you, I will just kind of give my idiot's 30-second depiction of the story, and then you can be the source of insight who fills in those gaps. Sound good?
Yeah, good luck. There's a lot in this.
There really is. And first off, I will say two, I guess, quasi caveats. One is if you have not read up on this story, you should. There's a great story on adweek.com that Stephen wrote called How JWT Was Hit With and Lost a Lawsuit About Discriminating Against Men. So you can read up on that. That is not only has all the major details, it has the entire tribunal report, which is basically the decision that came down. The whole thing is in there, literally embedded in there. So you can read it for yourself if you want to find out any other details. I mean, it's what is it, like 80 pages, Stephen? It goes on a long ways. It's detailed.
Yeah, highly detailed, but this is legal documentation, so we know what we can what we're reading here is pretty close to the truth. And what's fascinating about it is we're getting to see the goings on behind an agency that, I mean, we know what happened to it ultimately. It was folded into a larger part of WPP, but now we can see a lot of the reasons why as well.
Yeah, and so it really is a mix of both the financial woes that J. Walter Thompson was going through, especially in the UK back then. Was it 2018 are we talking about? And then also, yeah, just the inside. There were some public conversations around JWT, its gender gap, its lack of diversity at the time. But now we know what those conversations were like on the inside as well, and how that ended up leading to this lawsuit. The other just quick explanation I'll give for Americans is that this is a tribunal, which, Stephen, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand, it's basically, it's not quite the same as an American court, but in the end, they were able to call witnesses, almost like the way we would think of a congressional hearing here. They were able to call these witnesses in, interview them about exactly what happened, and then determine for themselves as a body, this is what happened and this is not worth. So in the end, they said they were not spoiler alert here, but in the end, they said these guys accused JWT of discriminating against them based on their sexual orientation, their age, all these other things. They threw out all that. And in the end, they said, we do believe the agency discriminated against them based on their sex as males. That their firing was unfair. And then it threw out the others. But this is a body that basically listened to all that testimony, called those witnesses, and then determined its findings, which to be clear, is now being will very likely be appealed by Wunderman Thompson, the agency that survives JWT. So because of that, we end up with this exhaustive document that basically details everybody that was involved with this case, just about, right?
Yeah. Wunderman Thompson have definitely said they're going to appeal. So this continues to be a live case, which means we have to be slightly careful not to offer any opinions on the actual case itself and only state the facts. So I will be very hesitant in how I explain what happened. But to outline, I mean, this started in 2018 when JWT was, and this word comes up quite a lot in the documentation, seen as being a traditional agency, which to most of us probably means that it mainly liked doing TV ads. So that was at the time when things were starting, more and more clients were looking to digitalize their communications, and JWT was struggling to bring in new accounts of significance, and therefore it was having to make, it seemed like, especially in 2018, a number of redundancies in order to shore things up, which when you're not winning work and you're having to lose people, just must feel so difficult. It must be so hard to work in that culture. So amid all of this, the creative team, two creatives, Chaz Bayfield and Dave Jenner, they were creative directors. They'd just been promoted the year before to a role, a management role for the creative team. And they started to feel a bit paranoid about what was going on in terms of the agency and how worried it was over its gender pay gap, which was very poor. It was at the top of the league table for agencies in terms of just how poor it was. And that really did freak out the agency. We can see that within the documentation. And so their response was to go to a conference in London, run by an organisation called Creative Equals, where two of the creative teams stood up and spoke about how they, and this word has come back to haunt and continually, wanted to obliterate the reputation of being an agency that was basically just hiring white straight men and promoting them. And I mean, my understanding is that is very much what JWT's reputation was for decades. So this is something they went on stage and said, we want to change this. Now, that had nothing by the looks of it, and all involved claimed they were, when they made this statement, they were unaware that there was going to be another round of redundancy or consultation on this front. But having said this, the creative team, five men within the creative team, took issue with what they had heard, and they raised a complaint, which the agency says it tried to explain the wording and try to allay their fears over their own future. But ultimately, they did face a consultation, and they were made redundant. So as a result, two of those, the creative directors, sued the agency and have won the case, which seems to have surprised the industry. It's really caught it off guard. But what we've seen internally is what a lot of mistakes from the agency side when they were asked for notes from meetings to prove that the consultation took place and nobody was aware on stage. They just didn't have notes. They can't give any evidence to when meetings took place and when people were told what, which is incredible. You would think basic thing to do. But the claim they made was that these notes might have been lost during the merger with Wonderman, which happened pretty much to save JWT. But it just seems incredible that they would have known this lawsuit was coming up, but still cannot prove when things were said, when things were decided, who decided what. So that has been, I think that's amazing to me that that's come out. But then there's so much else to it as well. It just never stops.
Yeah. I should at this point interject too, that after our coverage, about 2 weeks after we broke this story, the Daily Mail covered this, which cover it, I use the word cover loosely, really just did an absolute a hit piece on a woman who was unrelated to this lawsuit. And you know, they really basically turned this story from being what the reason we're discussing it today is because I think there's some really fascinating conversations that should come out of this lawsuit in the terms of to Stephen's point about documentation, about how this is an agency that identified a gender pay gap, attempted to discuss it both publicly and to address it internally, and in the process, through a lack of documentation, through some what sounds like going through this lawsuit, they really kind of went back and forth with these kind of more senior male employees of saying like, no, you're going to be fine, you're fine. And then saying, well, actually, you're laid off. And actually, we're only laying off the white men. And then there is one moment in this lawsuit, which feels particularly damning, where there was a woman who was also going to be laid off alongside these men, and a leader, one of the, I believe a creative leader, removed her from the list of those being made redundant. And when the tribunal asked, you know, why her, why didn't she get cut with the rest of these, they had nothing to offer, no paperwork, no justification. I will say, as someone who's been through management training, you get told a lot, document everything, you know, document who you hire and fire and why, and don't ever end up, if you want to end up in a law, like really losing in court, you go in with absolutely no documentation about why you made a decision. So there's that aspect. Unfortunately to me, the Daily Mail story is unfortunate in countless ways. But the real thing that infuriates me about it, beyond its ad hominem attacks on someone who should not have been dragged into it, it just dropped a big turd in the pool, is the metaphor I keep using, which is gross, but is accurate of like, no one can talk about this case now without talking about that Daily Mail story, which sucks. You know, the article sucks, but also it sucks that we can't have a bigger conversation as an industry about this. Shannon, I apologize that Steve and I have been just like ranting back and forth about this case, but I'm curious, when you first saw this, What was your first response, and then what response have you seen in the industry as this story has kind of percolated and grown these weird new heads of how it's been discussed online?
Well, my first initial thought was, well, this does nobody any favors. when you talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think that there is a misconception about what that means. It's not about the presence per se. It's not about having a headcount. It's about how, one, how you get these underrepresented communities in the door, and also how they are given the tools to succeed. By from this standpoint, for if you have someone that is not meeting up to standards, isn't doing the job, and you know, isn't able to perform, and this is just a general statement. In terms of details of this ongoing case, of course, we don't have that. We won't know the full details of why this woman got to stay. But it's not about keeping marginalized talent within the walls, despite everything, whether they can do the job or not. It's just about making sure, like I said, they have the tools to succeed and that they are able to effectively use those tools. So keeping anyone around for the sake of checking off a box does not do anybody any favors. And it only bolsters these sort of derailing talks about meritocracy that we run into every time we talk about inequality in any industry. In terms of the industry response, on my end, I have not seen a robust industry response yet. And I don't know why that unsettles me, but it does. Just because I feel like this sets a very dangerous precedent for all the work that people in the DEI space have been doing. To let something like this devolve in the way that it has, I think is going to fuel a lot of derailing, a lot of conversations that have previously derailed progress. And I don't know, the quiet kind of unsettles me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been no shortage of response to, again, to the Daily Mail article, mm-hmm. Which understandably and rightly infuriated many people. And that's where it's like, I feel this weird obligation on our end to say, like, okay, let's set aside this giant pile of garbage that is this, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And not let that, like, you can't not acknowledge mm-hmm. it. But at the same time, I don't want that to define the way that this case is talked about, because I say this as someone who covered courts for years. I've never said, please read the legal documents or please read the details of this case, because normally cases are pretty, you know, self-evident. This is one where, like, every agency executive should read this lawsuit, right? It's so, like, there's so many unforced errors. There's so many, like, the thing that really bothers me and bothers anybody who advocates for inclusion is, you know, you've got this powerful speech at Creative Equals that Stephen talked about about this gender pay gap and how JWT was trying to address its reputation. Then you had this group of kind of more older white men in the agency who felt threatened by, as Stephen mentioned, the word obliterate specifically. They were saying they wanted to obliterate the reputation, but there's a part in the lawsuit where they say, we just heard that in this presentation, they said they want to obliterate all of us white men. And the agency basically said in response, HR, you know, it's just like, no, that's not what this is about, which is true. That is not what that was about. But then they, like, it really becomes clear reading through the lawsuit that the agency, like, kind of did everything they could to make these guys feel like, no, dude, you're fine. That's not what this is about. And then to, like, come back later and be like, also, you're fired. You know, it's like the timeline, you can get a feel for, I think it would be easy to hear headlines like these and to hear about a case like this and say, oh, this awful tribunal that made this decision blatantly favoring white men. It would be understandable and easy to kind of look at it that way. I think when you read through the details, it's like the tribunal keeps saying, like, well, do you got any evidence? You got any, like, anything in writing that shows that that wasn't what happened, that you didn't fire them because of this? And like I said, in the end, they said it was that they found that the agency did discriminate based on sex and throughout the race and sexual orientation and other things.
And see, that's the, I'm sorry, but that's like the chilling part for as someone who, you know, comes from numerous marginalized communities. When you look at the lack of documentation, documentation isn't just meant to protect the entities or the companies. They also protect the workers. If you ask a lot of marginalized professionals, especially from the perspective of a Black woman, documentation on our end is key. It's so key. It arms us whenever we deal with certain situations that may appear discriminatory, that may seem like they, you know, don't necessarily favor us. We turn to our own documentation to back up every decision that we make, because that is so key when it comes to just, you know, protecting ourselves in these situations. The best things that any company, any agency can do for their employees is to document everything, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether it's about their retention, whether it's about their redundancy. You have to document things and make sure that there is just sort of a line, a paper trail of reasoning that leads to why they are receiving the treatment that they're receiving. By not documenting anything, you are putting your employees in great, great danger. I cannot stress that enough. Just that lack of like record is what really like sent like a chill down my spine, because that's what we use in any way to arm ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, I think if nothing else, if you listen to this podcast and you get nothing else away from it, document it, whether you are an employee, whether you are a manager, just document things. I mean, again, this was drilled into me at a very early age, mm-hmm. as someone who, you know, got into management in my probably mid-20s. And this was like literally my entire management training. It was not about how to be like necessarily a good manager. It was about how to stay out of court, or how, if you end up in court, to have documentation. Yep. And as someone who has since like been pulled into courtrooms time to time, and it's just like, sure, I'm glad stuff's in writing. So there's that. There's also just, again, I would really encourage folks to, if you've been following this case, or if you've only been following the understandable outrage around the coverage of it in the Daily Mail, like I would just really encourage you to kind of read through the details and to really digest to me. And again, to Stephen's point, we're not here to offer legal advice, although obviously we keep saying document everything. I don't think anyone's going to disagree with that. But I will say this, that Shannon, and I'm fascinated to hear what you think of this, but to me, when you talk about making a more inclusive workplace and really embracing DEI in serious ways, to me, it's about your hiring and recruiting and your leadership development. It's not about who you fire, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the scary thing about this one, is that it does give fodder to this subset of people who believe that diversity is about removing white men from the equation, right? Which is ridiculous. But cases like this, where they don't have any documentation to prove otherwise, so they end up being found essentially guilty of it, that to me was the heartbreaking thing about this, is I'm just like, you know, you're just going to convey this idea that diversity is about who you get rid of, not who you bring in. And I feel like, if nothing else, hopefully agencies will just start really factoring in, instead of just being terrified and being chilled by this verdict, instead just think about like, well, let's make it a big part of how we recruit and not necessarily how we terminate.
Right. And that's what I mean by saying that it sets a dangerous precedent. You haven't just created this awful situation for the people who have been left, who have been fired. You've created this sort of volatile environment for the people who have remained behind, especially if they are members of marginalized communities. And, you know, we've seen it time and time again through entertainment, through medicine. When you talk about, you know, this meritocracy system, when you say that, hey, there is a deep, deep system of inequality that runs through these industries, and you always have very typically the dude bros that come and go, no, it's meritocracy, it's about who deserves it. And when you try to say like, hey, that's not the case, like it's about, you know, getting really great talent through the door that may not have that access, this doesn't really do anything to help our argument. If anything, it helps those who scream meritocracy, meritocracy, you know, you got here because of who you are, not what you can do. All this does is fuel that. And you only need one example to really bolster that side of things. And this was just such an expensive, costly, costly example.
I do wonder as well, we talk about precedent, but I do wonder who's going to learn from this story that if they feel they've been let go. I mean, women have talked for decades about how unfair a profession can be, and many will have lost their jobs through unfair decision making within businesses. I wonder who's going to learn from having read this story and use it as a precedent. And maybe it might actually save people in their livelihoods as well.
Yeah, I will be curious to see, you know, the, unfortunately, like I think there, again, I think there are the takeaways from this that people, that employers should take, that any individual should take, which in this case, it was like a battle of documentation, right? And the plaintiffs won because they kept all those emails and the burden was really left on the employer to prove that the discrimination was not the reason that they got rid of these folks. But, you know, it's unfortunately we live in this era where, to Shannon's point about all it takes is one, right? All it takes is one case to become, even if it's not necessarily the kind of legal precedent, like people are going to remember this as a case about discriminating against straight white older men, even though all of that was thrown out except sex, right? Like, even though in the end, the actual verdict was they unfairly fired these people because they were men. Because the agency could not, according to the tribunal, prove that wasn't the reason. They had really no evidence. And instead, it's going to be remembered as this sort of like referendum case study in the, you know, the resilience of whatever of straight white men. It's like it's so frustrating. And that's why it's just everything about this. It's like it's one of those cases where, and these come up, you know, where it's like, you don't side with anybody, and there is no good guy in the sense here of just, you're just like, well, that both sides being pretty, I don't know. Anyway, I will just say, read the details again, as this is not me trying to drive people to adweek.com. This is just me trying to get people, to really spend a little time with the story itself and the details of it. Even if, you know, you're still publicly discussing the more visceral parts of this case, that's fine. Like, I think a lot of the outrage around the coverage of it has been completely justified and really important, and heartbreaking in a way, too. But I think the main reason we brought it up on the show is just to really encourage people to spend some time reading through the details, because they're out there. You can read them. They're not buried in an archive. And it's the UK. It's not every country, but you can bet that every ad agency, that everybody's looking at this one.
It's never long. It's never long after the UK something does something that it becomes relevant in the US. So it's definitely read over the case. If anything, just as you mentioned, a case study of what not to do, and just bear in mind that every bit of effective work that you do within your agency protects all of your employees, including your marginalized ones. Getting rid, seemingly, I mean, of course, again, pending case, so we're not making any judgments here, but ostensibly getting rid of your white men doesn't necessarily do us any favors. Just, again, create a responsible culture, and that includes hefty documentation, which we should all be doing. Yeah.
All right. Well, Stephen, thank you so much. Thank you for your coverage. It's been really spectacular. It's been, as we've seen, the extremes of how poorly this case can be covered, it's made me especially appreciative of having Stephen and the responsible coverage he's brought to this. So thank you for that, and thank you for joining the conversation today.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we're back, we'll be with Jason Lynch, our TV editor, to talk about the Olympics and how that's going this year in terms of audience, ad sales, and streaming. So we will be right back. Stick with us. All right, we're back. And we've got Jason Lynch, who covers the TV industry here at Adweek. He's been covering it for a very long time and has seen many Olympics, Olympuses. And Jason, always a pleasure to have you on the show. And thanks for joining us to talk about the Olympics.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
All right. Well, let's talk big picture. I feel like the themes, I should be transparent here that my Olympics viewing this year has been limited to highlights. I now watch the Olympics, I realize, the way I watch Saturday Night Live, which is that I just wait and see what everyone's talking about the next day, and then I watch like a 30-second highlight of it. What have you seen this year in terms of any kind of confusion in the marketplace about where to watch it or where to find it, and just kind of how those options went over this year? It feels like this was the first Olympics in this kind of era since the true streaming explosion.
For sure. So this is the first Olympics that Peacock, which is NBC Universal streaming service, is a part of it. And it's also kind of the most expansive Olympics they've ever had, in the sense that I feel like every Olympics, certainly that I've written about, there's been these complaints of like, why are all the best sports like on a tape delay? Like, I already find out what happened before, you know, they air. Like, why can't we watch these things live? Well, this year you can watch everything live. The issue I think that a lot of consumers are having is figuring out where to access that live programming. So we all know NBC, you know, you go to NBC for primetime highlights. But finding these events and finding out, you know, where they're actually airing in real time has been the bigger issue. And I think what's happening is everybody has heard this marketing mantra about, you know, Peacock, Peacock, Peacock this year. So you're going to Peacock, but you can't find all the events on Peacock. You can only find the Peacock events on Peacock. And I think this what some people are struggling with and complaining about is this trying to piece together the Olympic experience on their own. Now, if you go to something like the NBC Sports app, and if you're a cable subscriber and kind of authenticate that way, that does a pretty good job of pointing you in the right direction. But a lot of people aren't doing that. You're going to Peacock or you're going to NBC, and then maybe you're just throwing in the towel because you're just, you know, it's just too tough to find out, you know, where your favorite sport is airing, especially if you're trying to watch a live like gymnastics event at like 6 a.m.
Well, the classic metric, obviously, of Olympics viewership is the primetime ratings. I think if you're following this closely enough to be listening to this part of the podcast, you probably know they're not looking great, right?
They're not. You know, as of right now, and we're recording this on a Thursday, the most up-to-date numbers we have right now is that the Olympics in primetime are averaging 17.5 million primetime viewers, and that's across this total audience delivery metric that NBCU uses that also includes streaming, other platforms, you know, linear, cable, streaming, digital. So it's everything within primetime. That, you know, compared to most TV viewing these days, especially, is huge. However, the Rio Games averaged 27.5 million, which was 10 million more in prime time, again, on the same total audience delivery dynamic. So that's a 36% decline in ratings. So that is, you know, you're losing more than a third of your primetime audience, which is, that's pretty massive.
Is that about, I mean, waning interest? Is it about geography and the delay? Is it about changing behaviors? What are you seeing?
It's a little bit of all. So we knew going into this that the ratings were going to be down, in part because, as I mentioned before, you can watch these events live. So if I'm watching, you know, track and field live, and I know that actually doesn't happen until next week, I'm probably not going to go back into prime time and watch the highlights. Or maybe, you know, to what you were saying earlier, you hear everybody buzzing about something. Maybe I found the clip of that race online. So I don't need to go to primetime now to see it. So you are, I think a portion of that decline is because people are watching it elsewhere in other platforms. Maybe they're watching it live. And NBC, you expected that going in, but as sources told me in my reporting, and then also the CEO of NBC Universal confirmed publicly in his investors call this morning, the primetime ratings are lower than they thought they were going to be. I mean, I think they expected to take a hit. Did they expect to lose a third of their primetime audience? No, they didn't.
So how are ad sales looking, the guarantees that they make to these advertisers promising them a certain amount of viewership? How's that going?
Yeah, so it's, you know, listen, it is not, I think even privately they will say, listen, the ratings are not what we hoped they would be, but it's not the 33% or 36%, or, you know, just say roughly a third loss in ratings is not is not, it does not equal kind of a third, that they're missing their ratings guarantees by a third. You know, what I've been told is that, first off, these total audience delivery guarantees, it's like across the entire platform, all different day parts. So nobody, you're not allowed to just buy inventory in prime time. You're buying it across kind of a mix of different outlets, of different day parts. So that figure reflects that. And I'm told that right now, the disparity between what the guarantee was and what the ratings are is more in like the 15 to 20% range, which is still big. It's not as big as 33%. And also I'm told this is kind of more in line with like the disparity in major sports events. I think, you know, a lot of companies would prefer to have to deal with make goods later on. Then it turns out that, you know, you kind of undercharge advertisers. So that is what NBC Universal is preparing to do already. These conversations have been underway. I think by the time this airs, some advertisers were already beginning make goods. So what happens is kind of the second half of the Olympics, NBCU was reserved a percentage of the inventory that they hadn't, their inventory that they hadn't sold yet. And the idea was if there was under delivery, they would then give those, that inventory to their advertisers as a make good for the audience under delivery, because these ratings, even though they're lower, they're so much bigger than anything else on TV that you can't really like give somebody a make good and like, you know, just a random primetime show that's going to air a week after the Olympics. It's going to be, you know, a tenth of what this audience is. So as of right now, as we're talking, NBCU, it feels fairly confident that they are going to be able to bridge that gap with the existing inventory that they have for make goods within the Olympics themselves.
So, I mean, I know it's very difficult to look ahead, much less like 4 years, but you know, have we reached a point where the technology of viewership, of the way we watch TV is just changing so dramatically that it is now apples and oranges to try to compare any one Olympics to another? A four-year cycle for the Summer Games, I mean, that's an infinity of streaming time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that the industry has just changed so seismically since those Rio games, which were 5 years ago. I mean, think of all the streaming services that didn't exist and just the way that we all watch TV. So I think, you know, certainly we're never going to go back to that. I think what's happening right now, which are issues I hope are kind of fixed down the line, is you really do need, there is still, I think, a desire for the games. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of other issues at play this year with the COVID of it all. I think there are some people who just don't feel comfortable watching the games, don't think the games should be taking place, and perhaps in a quote-unquote normal year would have been making more of an effort to watch. I do think all of these kind of media companies, but especially NBC Universal, since they have the games through 2032, need to come up with more of like a like one-stop shopping for this. So again, the NBC Sports app has that a little bit. People don't really think to go there right away, but people who want to watch the Olympics need to go to one place. And for some people, they thought that was Peacock, to say, okay, I want to watch it. What are all my options in this same, you know, this one home screen or homepage or whatever, and then just point me in the right direction, as opposed to like what I think some people feel like this is a wild goose chase. So I think the big issues that have the big work NBC Universal has to do is to just kind of smooth out the process, you know, make it more frictionless and just make it easier for people to watch the content they want to watch.
Well, it's like in some ways it feels like it's going to be, you know, so long before the Olympics are back around. You and I have both also been covering this industry for so long now that it also feels like we're going to blink and we'll be having the same conversation again.
Well, but actually this year we are going to blink and we're having the same conversation because the Winter Olympics happen in just 6 months from now.
I know. It's
they're already, NBCU is already very heavily into preparations for those Olympics. I will be interested. I was just talking to my colleague, Kelsey Sutton, our streaming editor. And I said, I'll be interested to see just what changes they're going to make on the streaming front just in those 6 months to again, try, I think, to improve the experience for those people who were going to Peacock and just thought that they'd be able to watch anything they wanted and they can only watch a handful of events. So I think that's really what they need to focus on for future games. Or otherwise, I think we're going to just have these same issues of people kind of trying to find their game, what they want to watch, and then maybe just kind of, you know, deciding it's not worth the effort, and they'll just wait for the highlights later.
Great. Well, Jason, thanks so much for joining the conversation, and I would encourage everyone to check out Jason's coverage, our colleague Kelsey Sutton's coverage. As you mentioned, there's a lot on adweek.com if you want to learn more about the ratings, and quite a bit will probably have happened between now and when this podcast comes out. So stay tuned to adweek.com for that. Thanks so much, Jason. Always a pleasure.
All right. Happy to be here. Thanks.
All right. Our theme music is by Home. This week's episode was produced by Nick Gardner and edited by Lane McGibney. If you have not already, please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Those reviews mean a lot to us personally, and they help new listeners discover the show. You can reach us anytime at podcast@adweek.com. That's podcast@adweek.com. For Adweek, I'm David Greiner, and we will be back next week. Thanks.
Hey there, are you ready to elevate your personal brand or company? Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for video content and audience building. Imagine growing your brand organically on social media without the hassle of editing videos for hours. With Viral Growth, it's a breeze. They handle the brainstorming, scripting, and editing while you simply just hit record. And don't worry about your niche. They cater to everyone, from business and marketing to health and wellness. Are you ready to make waves in the social media realm? Visit viralgrowth.io and use code ADWEEK, that's ADWEEK, all lowercase, and get 10% off your plan.